Now, F Eric offered reel four.
In the tank brigade exercises you were involved in during these years, were there any that stand out in your mind for any reason at all, because they were more eventful or because you felt you learnt more from them or any reason like that?
Well, it's true to say that not a single exercise could go by without you didn't learn something because of this approach of hobos, of making certain everybody on in the picture and knowing what was going on and what was meant to go on and so on. By and large, it's incidents more than the things that stand in one's mind. And one, of course, one clearly remembers is when we had this. And I don't even know in those days whether they had a code word for an exercise. I don't think they did. But here the tank brigade were pitted against the, when I say the tank brigade, the mobile force, which is the tank brigade, and I think George Lindsay's infantry brigade. They moved from where they were at Till's Head up to Gloucester as a starting point. It was about 60 miles. So the old mediums whistled off there, all the stuff, and the infantry brigade, and they were given the task of attacking, whatever formation it was, a division on Salisbury Plain. And we spent a couple of days, I suppose, at Gloucester while the people were framing up, and then got the order to move, and at last, like, it was, we moved down from Gloucester to the plain. 5th Tanks moved through Savernake, from through Marlborough to Savernake Forest. The rest of the brigade, and it surprised me at the time, but you know, there was no attempt at very much concealment about this move of ours. This was part of the drill to let the opposition appreciate that we were parked up in Savernake Forest. While we did this, the rest of the brigade flanked off, went off to a flank a bit, and motored down and took up a position completely unknown to the enemy in a place called Cake Wood, the other side of Savernake Forest. Now, we came down there and between about 2 miles outside Marlborough, coming from the north, we were met by an umpire who stopped the CO who was leading Justice Tilley, the leading tank, and said the culvert's broken, you know, you can't go on. This is obviously delaying tactics. Now, I was next to Justice's tank, so I knew what was going on. And he said, right, through the field. Do you want me to go? It was just a culvert, nothing. So we went on, got through Marlborough, got to this place. We were going into Savernake Forest. Then as time went on, the echelon were coming through. The umpires were knocking off every other vehicle with our resupply in rations and this, that and the other. When this news got through to Justice Tilley in Savernake Forest, he turned to one of the medium section commanders, a fellow named Morris, and said, right, go down to Marlborough and get them back. So fellow Morris roared off to get them back and had a bit of battle because some enemy were arriving by that time. A few blank three-pounders went off, and the odd shop window went to six, and a girl had a heart attack and this, that and the other, so they said. And he brought the transport back. And despite the umpires. Then, it was fairly unbelievable, it's bloody funny really, because of course, then the next thing that happened in this way in Savernake Forest we were officers' wives in their motor cars of the enemy, particularly the cavalry, were doing recce for them, finding out where they were. And we didn't mind because we want them to know where we were. But of course, this was the sort of movement on foot. Anyway, While the opposition were fussing about us, whether they knew we were, they had no idea, I gather, the other two battalions in the brigade, who debouched from Cape Wood, swept right through the bloody gun lines and put all the horses to flight and that sort of thing. And the whole thing was ended up a couple of days earlier as a schmozzle. Now, this to us was meant to be almost the final examination for the tank brigade, see whether they were any value in the army or not, or tanks, I suppose, for that matter. But the point is that in that exercise up at Gloucester with us, we had the motorised infantry brigade, but of course, and a gunner outfit of some sort. But of course, that motor infantry brigade were mounted in the 28-seater bus. They came down. Now, whatever happens, if they're in buses, sooner or later they have to get out of them. And so the last 10 miles or 5 miles, which is across country, is apt under those conditions to be either wait for the infantry for some hours or get on with it yourself, and it's a matter of timing, I suppose. The outcome of this exercise was they had the wash-up at Tidworth. Remember now, was they came away, a fellow named Copper Finlayson, I think it was, who was GOCNC Southern Command, and he came up to Hobo and said, "I won't have commanding officers threatening general officers." He was referring to this Marlborough business, you see, Justice Tilley. And Hobo said, "Well, General, if general officers allow themselves to be threatened by commanding officers, there's nothing more I can be said about it." Now, this is the chap, Finlayson, who I reckon gave Hobo the bowler hat years later in Egypt. To make the point about whether Hobo had any doubts about this, in 1941 I was in exercise and I was at the side of the road under the trees, and a staff car with about 5 stars on it rolled up, and all the bloody red tape in the world, red flannel in the world, got out. And they were accompanied by a chap dressed as a home guardsman, not a corporal. I looked, and Christ, there was Hobo. So I leapt off my tank and rushed across to greet him. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, I command the finest section of Home Guard in the country. Every old gentleman, absolute killer." And I said, "Now, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, your corps commander, you see, he commands an armored corps, asked me to come out and show him how to handle one." And then Hobo straight away went into a dissertation about how we were wasting our time, because until we had the infantry mounted in armored carriers where they could keep up at infantry pace, the opportunity would be lost if they were any sort of wheel transport, as they were, of course, at that time. Now, simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, was a fairly good indication of the way his mind was certainly running then, if it hadn't been running before.
This exercise you've described with the infantry and cavalry units involved and the cavalry officers wise, this obviously wasn't a tank brigade exercise. This was
a major the mobile force.
Aha, that was the mobile force, yes. In that mobile force exercise, did you learn anything about attitudes of other arms to the tank?
No.
I'm wondering if there were any sort of prejudices. Or
well, I say, one understood the other arms. I think, particularly as I think General Brigadier Lindsay was commanding him, who was very go-ahead and had been in tanks at one time, in fact, he was a gunner, I think. They were all dead keen on it, provided they could join in, you know. But it meant if they had to dismount from their buses, they couldn't even get them into the woods, say, where we were. They had to go. You see, they had to. This was the difficulty, getting them going at the same pace.
Yeah. At the end of tank brigade exercises, was there usually a debrief, as it were?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Always on tank brigade exercises. Always. Then that, of course, was followed by the army manoeuvres. And this was great fun, really, because one had the opportunity to get going. You saw all the other arms, even when you drove through them and set them tonight. But I'm saying, it was so stupid. I remember now coming on an army exercise down between Winchester and Andover. And there was one of the umpires on his horse on the roadside, or on the verge of the road. And I recognised a fellow I knew through playing rugger, James Unwin. So I just said to my driver, decelerate, knowing James wasn't much of a horseman. And he sort of lifted his foot off the muddy pit, and he got this tremendous explosion in the exhaust. And the umpire, complete with James and horse, just disappeared into the blue, you see, just as simple as that. The other sort of instance, sticking one's mind, and another of these army exercises, I was given the role of seizing Figbury Ring, which is quite a feature between Salisbury and Stockbridge. And I bashed on to seize this Figbury Ring, and that Figbury Ring has an ancient earthwork on top in a protected place. It's got a big ditch, like an old British village or something. And I got there, and there, actually inside the ring, which was forbidden to troops, a complete squadron, I think, of the 4th Dragoon Guards. Well, there they were. Nothing I could do about it. I wasn't allowed to go in. And then, being young and a bit keen, having had a nice motor down, I thought, well, come on, here goes, chaps. And I went over the top into the midst of this bloody squadron. And they went like that. And there, beautiful viewpoint. You could see this squadron of horses. They were just going. And there were these four men. Well, it's perfectly right, except that when I came out, got out, somehow I find out, lost my map case. Came off the top of the tank in the big jump, I suppose. And as one wasn't allowed to go in one of these things with tanks or soldiers, in fact, I thought I'd better confess to Justice Chilly, my CO, that night and told him what had happened. That's the job. You know, that sort of could be better. But as you could see in the sight of this squadron of horses taken off, going, whoosh, never traveled so fast in their lives.
In the army exercises that you were involved in with the 5th Battalion, what kind of roles were usually allotted to the battalion?
Well, this was one, this seizing a feature. So the infantry could come up and occupy it, you see. That was the... or a sweep through the enemy's gun lines or rear. You know, having had a go round the flank, then come up through the gun lines, and again all the hairies would go off and the gunners couldn't possibly turn their guns. They didn't have the ammunition probably to fire at you anyway. And, you know, one could create absolute havoc in that sort of way. They were largely, rather than straightforward attacks against enemy defensive positions.
Were there in the army exercises any close infantry support roles you were given?
No. No, you see, because we were the tank brigade. Now, the 4th Tanks, the infantry tank battalion, used to come down for these army manoeuvres, and they would do that close support business, necessary, you know, with the life tried to depict the advancing at infantry pace with the attacking infantry, the assault wave, the support wave, and the reserve wave. The whole lot going at infantry pace, with the infantry.
Do you think that the involvement of the tank brigade in the army exercises and their effectiveness in those exercises, how did that affect, do you think, the reputation of the tank corps within the army as a whole, because this was the main opportunity which you had to impress.
I think within the army as a whole, absolutely pin high. You know, I'm sure of that. And with many of the cavalry officers of a certain rank, because one knew some of them quite well. But of course, how much impact that had on the entrenched higher command, the general and so on, I just wouldn't know, because I'm sure that they were generally hostile to anything that hadn't happened before, you know, just like that.
Mm. But at your level, you never encountered any of these kind of prejudices?
No. I think they thought, you know, the wish was, thank Christ, if we were in your outfit, you know. Because it's great fun, this tanking, you see. I'm saying the next best thing to a game of rugby football that I know is an exercise, a tank exercise. Bloody marvellous, you know, great fun. And I've never, until the day I finished commanding my third regiment, I still felt the same. Used to love it.
These, both the army manoeuvres and the brigade exercises were, to a certain extent, reported in the press. Did the press reports interest you?
Oh, immensely, oh yes. Because, you see, at that time, the we called him the tapeworm. Oh, Little Heart was then military correspondent for the Times. And he used to report all these exercises, of course, at great length. Because he had a hell of a reputation at that time, in the way of a sense, of course. But he really, you know, was the acknowledged military critic. And often he'd expounded new beliefs, which to some degree fitted in with his tank brigade operation, you know, the soft spot and so on. And we, of course, read them with great interest. And when we came in from exercise, possibly having been out a week, got in, and chaps just rushed to the ante room to pick up the times for the last week, just to go through them. Just you might look at looking for a test score or whether you've got a winner on the, you know, a horse. Before you had wireless and television, that sort of thing, pumping the thing out endlessly. Nobody had a wireless set themselves, you see, in those days. Certainly. Yeah.
Did people like yourself, who'd actually been involved in the exercises, feel that Little Heart's reporting of them was accurate and fair?
Yes, absolutely, of course. But then we were probably biased because Little Heart was invariably on the side, or, you know, was bound to be supporting Hobo's ideas, because after all they were fitted in with his philosophy. That you know, you don't hit the hard opposition, you hit it where it hurts, and you attack the brain or the supply or wherever it is and sort of castrate them up front.
After you left the 5th Battalion, you had a short spell with the 10th Armoured Car Company in India.
Yeah.
And you returned, and in June 1937 you were appointed to the 2nd Battalion, which was at Farnborough. I wondered whether there were any differences between, that you could detect from your experience with two different battalions, whether there were any significant differences between the training and the roles of the various battalions, apart from the 4th, which we've already...
Yes, no, well, they're in the same brigade, of course. The only differences really were in probably personality of the commanding officer. And I think on this, I reckon a regiment's performance, a battalion performance, and how they approach life is very largely governed by this factor, strange enough. Now, the CO we'd had in the 5th Tanks, Justice Tilley, was really a hell of a man. And tough, wiry, this, that, and other. I thought the world of him personally. And he'd been a bit of a boxer and this, that, and the other. And now, as a result of this, he was... how shall I put it? Never impressed, or completely devoid of any form of bullshit. He reckoned that we were tank soldiers and we were training for war, and that was that. And, you know, in the army they had this annual administrative inspection that they had then.
Sorry, this annual what?
Administrative inspection, where the general arrives and goes through all the entirely administrative, usually preceded by a parade. And it was entirely bullshit, really, inasmuch that everything had to be clean and, you know, spotless and polished. It's now a progress to a thing, they call it FFW, fit for war inspection. But there's nothing at all to do with this, with how well your tanks were, could perform, or how well trained your regiment was, or anything like that. And I can remember we had this thing in the 5th tanks, and strange enough, nothing happened. And Old Justice had just told the general that he thought, as the general was going to visit a tank battalion to his roof inspection, he thought he'd like to see the battalion work instead of sort of a raid for boots and whatever it was, putties and so on, for entirely something quite incidental. And sure enough, he did. Whereas in the 2nd, everything was much more sort of cut and dry than possibly less personal. I don't know really whether that's so, but this is partly by the fact that if you were in the 5th, as I was, of course, you thought they were the sort of God's chosen, whereas we reckon the 3rd were sort of chaps who didn't know the score, and the 2nd were chaps who were sort of too socially inclined to know anyway, and so it went on. Anyway, as far as the training went, I think very little difference at all. Now, I was lucky, in fact, that I went there as a blue-eyed boy, because I was invalided back from India on 6 months' leave, and they got one of those things during this leave. I'd supposed to be coming back. I'd come back from India a couple of months, 3 months before, supposed to be dying or something with this bloody infection I had, B. coli infection, and I happened to meet Colonel Pratt, who was commanding the 2nd. He said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm back to India. Of course, that's my profession." He said, "Oh, no, nonsense. I'll say there's trouble in your place. Otherwise, you'll catch this bug again." And I said, "Well, it's no good unless he's already done a tour." And I knew that was impossible, because in those days, chaps paid large sums of money to other chaps to do their tour in India. I didn't have any money anyway. And that was that. And then, about 6 weeks later, I was at Bovington, where they're having a call week. I met a chap named John Carlton, who was in the 2nd, incidentally. He was doing a radio course at Bovington. And we met in the club over. He said, "Oh, Eric, when you go back to India?" I said, "Oh, about 3 weeks' time." "I'd give all the rice in China to be in your place." I said, "Well, you can go." I think, "Oh, no," he said, "that Colonel Pratt put me on a sort of adverse report, and I tried to go to West Africa, the colonial troops, but he says he won't let me go for years. He's had another report on me." So I said, "Well, I'll fix that." And rang up Colonel Pratt and said, "Look, a fellow named John Carlton here wants to go to my place." He said, "Right, hand him over all your tickets and wanted on voyage." And he went, and I went to the 2nd. That's why I came there, you see. This is very unusual. It was about just a year in India and then straight back. So I was still in, as it were, up to date in tank brigade ways. Mm. Well, then it so happened in that training season, the Douglas Pratt, the CO, went off somewhere, and my company commander took over the regiment temporarily, named Fitzmaurice, and I commanded the squadron for some reason unknown to me. And we had a very good manoeuvre season.
What were the features of it?
Well, I don't remember. But the brigade was then commanded by Brigadier Patterson, and he very much adopted Hobo's outlook on briefing and debriefing after exercises. And I think there was very little difference in the performance. The big exercise we went on, that I remember now, that we went, you know, companies on different centre lines about 5 miles apart and advanced to contact. And I don't really think there was any difference in the use of armour and that sort of thing than there was before.
I see. You mentioned Corps Week. Was that a regular thing, and what did it...
That had been a regular thing every year, where all the battalions gathered, or the athletes of the battalion gathered, and they had inter-regimental athletics competition and tennis, the whole lot. A couple of ball dances, and, you know, it was a week's jollification with athletics and stuff like that thrown in.
Did it have any more serious purpose other
no,
than...
No, none at all, entirely no. social.
No.
That, I can well remember now, the only thing I remember, one of the debriefings that Brigadier Patterson was giving, perhaps this gives an indication of somewhat, a bit of a change. The battalion I had with the second pushed on very hard and ran in a certain amount of opposition, you know, anti-tank guns then were chaps armed with a flag which they waved when they were firing, they were firing, if there were no anti-tank guns and such. And at the debriefing, Brigadier Patterson criticised Fitzmaurice, the acting battalion commander, for pressing on too hard without sufficient cover. And I remember now Fitz stood up and he said, "Well, you see, Brigadier, often the bark of the dog behind is worse than the bite of the dog in front."
Towards the end of 37, you were nominated to go on a 3-month gunnery instructor's course. How did you get that appointment, and what was the course about?
It wasn't quite like that. I was posted as an instructor to the gunnery school, having never done an instructor's course. And I went there and did this 3-month course, an ordinary instructor's course, and then became an instructor there. Mm-hmm. And I personally didn't want to go there because I, you may recognize a regimental soldier and always have. However, I went, and there it was.
What sort of course did they put you through?
Oh, entirely gunnery.
Yes.
3 months. It was like a very detailed course one had done earlier on, if you like, except that you did the teaching as well. You had to lecture and teach the various subjects. Mm-hmm. Some of them, which were on NCO level, the sort of things that the sergeant instructor would be, how to strip the 3-pounder, for instance, which would be a thing which the sergeant would take. Normally in a thing, and the officer merely supervised by going around, the officer giving the lectures and that sort of thing, but we did it right down to that sort of thing, so you could actually teach any lesson that the instructor, sergeant or instructor, would have to teach. Very detailed. So by the time you finish that, one really very competent on the mechanical side anyway, because it really was entirely the mechanical side of gunnery.
No tactics program?
No.
And after you finished the course, what appointment did you get?
After I finished the course, I started off supervising recruit training, young officer training, and then instructors' courses, and then the war came along, I suppose, and I was doing... I had dropped by this time the recruit training. I was doing entirely OCTU, the officers' training unit, training the officers and instructors.
I see. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the various courses you taught from the point of view of the differences between each. Now, the recruits course, what did that involve?
The recruits course was teaching the chap to use the weapons. The OCTU course...
The what?
The OCTU, Officer Cadet Training Unit, only came along in the war. That was really the emphasis there, was teaching the chap to be a tank commander and supervise the weaponry. And the instructor's course, of course, was to give him the instructional preparation so that he could teach instructors, teach chaps, instruct in gunnery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So really three different sort of levels.
Yes. And were you teaching them gunnery tactics as well as the weapons themselves?
This didn't really came in, it wasn't meant to come into it, but I did sort of introduce it in the way of the best way to use the weapons, the best ground to use, how to apply your fire, say, from machine gun to get the beaten zone within the target area and things like that. Things that really hadn't been done much before properly. That, and then I was specialising as well in, there started what we called eye training, that is detecting targets and appreciating ground and things like that. But this was the thing that I'd started during the course of, it struck me that this ought to be included. Now, as a result of this, funding. Now, first of all, of course, I went to Lulworth, I'm certain, as an instructor, simply because Justice Tilley was the commandant there, and he thought he'd like to have me there, and that was that. Nothing to do with knowledge of gunnery or anything else. Now, it so happened that while I was there doing this instructor's course, and just after some time there, I really got this gunnery bug and had a tremendous interest in it. And so, as does happen, they thought I was pretty good at it, presumably, and the commandant.